thank you for a wonderful introduction. I feel so at home here at Trinity Baptist because I've participated in a number of events here, some of them sad, some of them very joyous. And when I was received early this morning, when I arrived here, I felt like I was back at Temple Bethel. I had so many friends here. My principal experiences related to what we know today as the Holocaust. And basically what the Holocaust was the government-sponsored attempt by the part of Nazi Germany to exterminate all of the Jews. I think that before we go into a deep examination of the Holocaust itself, we really must step back in history a little bit. Because the Holocaust, its very seeds and origins dated very far back. You and I are spiritual kinsmen by the virtue of the fact that Jesus Christ was born as a Jew, lived as a Jew, preached as a Jew, and died as a Jew. There's some attempt made to say that the Jews killed Christ. And of course, that's not true. And if you just take the very simplest fact that if you go back to the Old Testament, if a person was condemned to death in Judaism, he was stoned to death. The execution by Roman law was hanging on a cross. So just a very simple fact will sort of clear things up very quickly. After the death of Jesus Christ, Jews continued to live in what today is Israel until 70 AD, when once again they revolted against Roman law, which they felt was pagan. And there was a three-year battle, and I know many of you have been in Israel and have been to Masada. The very last Jews decided to commit mass suicide, not to fall in the hands of the Romans. They eventually dispersed throughout the Mediterranean, some of them in what today are Muslim countries, some of them up through to Europe. And there began, and this is a little bit technical from a Judaic point of view, but there began really basically two traditions in the Jewish religion, the Ashkenazi Jews, who were European, and the Sephardic Jews, who were basically of the Muslim Mediterranean type of persuasion. And philosophically, they were on the same book, but many customs were different. Interestingly enough, the Jews that lived in Spain from about 700 AD to 1492 were Sephardic Jews. And some of these Jews, which were expelled under Catherine and Isabella, unless they accepted forced conversion, eventually migrated to Holland. And when the first migration to the United States occurred, it was these Jews that first settled in the United States. And so many distinguished families who participated in the revolution and subsequently all came from the Sephardic Jewish tradition. Life was very difficult in Europe. And while there was amity and understanding between Jews and Christians in the first 200 years, the churchmen of the subsequent period could not comprehend how Jews would not recognize Christ. And so there gradually became, and I'll use the word, Satanization of the Jewish faith. They clearly made Jews out as the killers of Christ, and they painted them in the blackest and darkest ways. And consequently, the Jews that migrated and settled in Europe became second-class citizens. They had very few rights and privileges, and were second-class citizens, and were strictly living at the whims of the prince or governor or whoever was in power at that time. The worst period of persecution began with the Crusades, which lasted, as you know, for almost a century. And whenever the Crusaders were going through the country, they were very hard on the Jewish population. Another major outbreak, of course, of that kind of incident occurred in Spain, when under Ferdinand and Isabella, they decided that Jews must convert to Catholicism or be expelled. Many of them died at the stake. Many of them migrated to various parts of the world. Many of them converted to Catholicism, but deep in their hearts, they retained their Judaic tradition. And it's very interesting that many of these people fled to Mexico, and then things got a little bit uncomfortable there because they were concerned, and they migrated to Mexico. And many families of Mexican-American origin in New Mexico, the United States, New Mexico, in the last 20 or 30 years, all of a sudden began discovering that their family had practiced some secret rites, and that their families didn't eat pork, and that they lit candles on Friday night in the basements. And they then came to the realization that their forebears had been Jews who were converted to Catholicism, but they couldn't abandon their Jewish faith. During the 17th century, there became a major liberalization, and Jews were becoming admitted into society throughout Europe, particularly in England. Under Napoleon, there were some legislation passed which gave Jews full citizenship. Germany was a somewhat different situation, because if you examine the history of Germany, Germany had been fragmented into, some think, as many as 500 different states, municipalities, kingdoms, dukedoms. Everybody had their independent rulers. There was not a cohesive Germany in those days. There were a few states that were very dominant. Under Frederick the Great, Prussia became very dominant and became a major military power. The Bavarians were always strong, as were the Saxons. And Austria, which had a sizable empire because it ruled some of its surrounding countries, was the linchpin of that. In 1870, under the leadership of Bismarck, Germany coalesced, and there was a war in 1870, and the French were very badly beaten, and the Germans became the major power in all of Europe. Now, I'm hoping I'm not boring you with some of this, but I think that you kind of have to understand how this all kind of falls together. The seeds of hatred planted in 1870 were dormant for some years until 1914, the First World War came. And in the First World War, France again battled against Germany, but it had allies with Great Britain and Russia. And eventually in 1917, we came to their help. And Germany and Austria were soundly defeated. One of the dark, and we now recognize that one of the dark parts of history was the Versailles Treaty, which extracted enormous reparations from Germany, which essentially bankrupted it. There was a democratic government formed, which is called the Weimar Republic, had all of the earmarks of being a constitutional, publicly, freely elected government, but the economics were so difficult that chaos occurred, and they had an inflationary cycle in which we are told that people would go shopping with a basket full of currency for a loaf of bread. Along came a man named Adolf Hitler, who had developed a series of ideologies which basically preached that the German nation is supreme and superior to all other nations. And in descending order, there are all other nations which all will be subordinate to Germany. The Aryan race was extolled as the most virtuous race. If you were blue-eyed and blonde, then you were at the top of the heap. Come to think of it, I'm green-eyed and blind. Where does that put me? And there began a systematic persecution of the Jews. A series of laws were promulgated, stripping them of their citizenship and stripping them of all of their rights. And that was the beginning of the Holocaust. I'm sure many of these are familiar to you, but that's where I came in because I was living in Czechoslovakia. My family had lived there for many hundreds of years. We lived a very good life. My father, incidentally, was employed by the British Dutch Shell Oil Company. And when trouble began and we sensed insecurity, the Shell Oil Company gave my father an opportunity to go to work in Venezuela. We had had family in the United States from the 1920s, and my mother said, no, if we're going to migrate somewhere, let's migrate to the United States. And we made application, but by the time the machinery of application began, the trap was set already, and we could not leave. So we ended up living for 2 years between 1940 and 42 in a state which was a fascist state sponsored by Germany with its Slovak puppets, very similar to what took place in Norway. And if the expression Quisling is familiar to you, the Norwegians had a fascist government under a man named Quisling, and that's where the term comes from. We were restricted to our homes from 8 in the evening till 8 in the morning. We had to wear yellow stars. Jews could not practice their professions. Their businesses were stripped of them. And then in 42, they began taking Jewish men of draft age and sending them to unknown destinations. At that point, my mother and father, with the help of a Christian friend of theirs, arranged our escape to Hungary, where we lived for 2 years. And it's a very long, difficult journey that I'm not able to go into now. But eventually, our destiny was to be apprehended and sent to Auschwitz. My sister and I both. I want to focus on my one-year experience in Auschwitz and its related camps and Mauthausen and Gunskirchen. Not in terms of really bad things that happened to me, but the acts of kindness that were shown to me. This is a Sunday, a day of God, and we ought to have good and positive thoughts. I arrived in Auschwitz in April of 44, and it is very difficult to imagine what that place looked like today. There's no way to adequately describe it, but all I can tell you is that we're huge encampments, each containing about 40 barrack buildings. Each of these were surrounded by barbed wire fences that which were approximately 10, 12 feet high and were electrified, so if you touched it, you immediately were killed. There were guard towers at each corner, and prisoners were shoved in relatively tight. The moment we got there, all of my possessions were taken from me. I was given a striped uniform, a striped cap, and they sorted us out, so I eventually ended up in a building with 800 boys. Most of them were 15 through 18. I was the youngest of the group, and there's possibly some speculation in my mind that as I went through the selection process, because when you came in on a train, the SS men were sort of guiding you, and there were people that were pointed to the right and people pointed to the left. The ones that went to the left were taken immediately to gas chambers and killed within a day. The ones that were to the right were then sorted out, and I was amongst those that were sorted out, and I was put into this camp. And as I said, we were given a shower. All of our hair was shaved. We were put into striped uniforms, and we were put into this barrack building that contained 800 boys. The nourishment we got was probably less than a third necessary for continued existence, so we were literally starved to death. After the first or 2 weeks after we became acclimated and we realized where we were, the camp immediately adjacent to us was known as the Camp D, where the prisoners were the prisoners that were employed in the worst jobs possible. They were cleaning out the gas chambers, they were taking the bodies, extracting the gold, shaving the heads, and then disposing of the bodies by putting them in the crematoria. By the virtue of the fact they were doing this kind of work, they were getting a little better rations. We began a dialogue, the 800 boys, each of them trying to find somebody from a nearby village or from a nearby town. And I did the same thing, although I thought my chances of doing that would be pretty slim. But lo and behold, I shouted across and I said, "I'm from Bardayov. Could you find somebody from there?" And somebody said, "Yes, we've got somebody here. Just come back next day." Next day, a man showed up. I really had not recognized him because a number of years have passed, of course. And his name was Robert Steinauer, and he had lived just a few blocks from our house. His family were actually German Jews that settled in Bardayov some generations earlier, but they retained German citizenship. And he was working there, and we had dialogued across the fence, and he asked me to come back the next day, and he threw me a half a loaf of bread. A half a loaf of bread in Auschwitz was worth fortunes, and it sustained me for a number of days. My memory of him is dear in my heart, and I kept thinking about him many, many years after I was liberated and came to the United States, and kept making inquiries about him. It turned out that he survived, and eventually I was able to locate him, and I got his telephone number, and he was living in Frankfurt, Germany. And so I called him. His name had changed. He was now known as Dr. Robert Scala. And I called him and I said, "Robert, don't hang up this phone. Let me tell you who I am and listen to my story." And I then proceed to relate to my grandfather and tell him who I am. And I said, "Do you remember throwing me half a loaf of bread?" And the man was so stunned that he couldn't speak. But the next year, Millie and I happened to have been in Europe, and we made a specific journey to Frankfurt. We had purchased some days before a very lovely porcelain set of dishes. And he and his wife came to our hotel, and we presented that to him, and I said, "This is just a token of my appreciation for the half a loaf of bread you gave me." And we spent 2 days together, and he shared his story with me, his story of survival. And then he told me how he went back to Prague, and the first day he was there, somebody said, "Your girlfriend survived. She lives at such and such place." And they met and they married, they had a child. He went to medical school, and by the late 50s became one of the most renowned radiologists throughout Central Europe. And mind you, in order to get into medical school, because the communists also had adopted anti-Semitic practices, particularly during the days when Stalin was already not emotionally well, and there's some trials, doctors' trials in Moscow, and a Czech communist tried to emulate those. So he changed his name and went through medical school, became very famous, and was invited to come and lecture to Vienna. And he and his wife and his small daughter, and they decided not to go back, but they migrated to Israel. Well, in Israel, you have too many doctors, and he could not earn a livelihood. Eventually, he received an invitation for a fellowship to Switzerland. He was there for 6 months, and then a German clinic outside of Frankfurt, about 40 kilometers away, a very famous spa town, invited him to come to be the resident radiologist. He accepted the post. The financial rewards were very good. He spoke a beautiful classical German. He was extremely well received. and then retired there just a year or two before Millie and I visited them in Frankfurt. So he was my first hero in Auschwitz. Several weeks after that encounter, I had met a prisoner who was a Polish Christian, was put into Auschwitz because of his political affiliations. He was active in a political party, and at this point it's a little obscure, which it was, but he befriended me, and he was the head of a building. Each building had a prisoner who was like the head honcho. His barrack building, I was in block 24, he was right across in block 25. His building didn't have any prisoners because the camp we were in, which was called Zigeunerlager, Camp E, had half of the prisoners were gypsies carted from all over Europe and were treated the same way with Jews, and they were mostly gassed. And his building was emptied some weeks before, and he didn't receive a replenishment of prisoners, so he essentially lived in a building by himself, was getting very ample rations. So he said, look, you're going to be my runner. Your responsibility is to keep this barrack building absolutely clean. And I received a great deal of food, which I shared with some of my buddies. I only could do the limited amount, but I lived pretty good. I had to report back every day for Appell. Appell was where you stood in ranks and were counted by SS officers. But he and I were able to dialogue and develop a very deep and warm friendship. About August of 44, he said to me, you know, the chances of you surviving here in Auschwitz are very slim. Your only chance to survive is to get out into one of the work camps. And I understand there'll be some SS officers coming who'll be looking for young boys who've had machine shop experience. I know you haven't had any, but I'm going to help you. And he took his little piece of paper and he drew a picture of an instrument which is used primarily for the measurement of metallic parts, and you can get it up to 1/10 of a millimeter in precision. And he did it very accurately, and I kept the picture and showed it to some of my friends. 3 days later, SS officers came. We were in ranks. They asked for volunteers. I was the first to volunteer, and I snapped a very sharp salute. I was then, and I still am, fluent in German. And we had a brief conversation, and he stuck this instrument in my hand. And I looked at it, and I said, 9.2. And he said, excellent, you stand over there. And before the next 5 minutes were up, they selected 49 other boys. We were marched off to the front of the camp. There was an administrative building. Our names were enrolled in their books. We were tattooed on our left arm. My tattoo number is B6168. It's a lucky number. And we were transported to Świętochowice, which was about 55 kilometers away. And it was the heart of the industrial district. I'm going to skip forward a little bit faster, but I just want to tell you that the Polish prisoner I've not been able to make contact with. I pray for him. I remember him in my heart, and I think that that keeps my relationship together with him. We were in this work camp under slightly better conditions till early January, when one morning we woke up and we were not taken to work because we heard what sounded like thunder in the background, but some of the old timers said, no, this is artillery fire. And this was, of course, middle of the winter. If you remember stories of the Battle of the Bulge, how cold Europe was that year, we had underwear and cotton striped uniforms. But they did allow us to take a blanket along and gave us a half a loaf of bread, and they put us in boxcars, and the boxcars began moving, the train began moving, and it took us 8 days to get from what today is Silesia to what is Upper Austria, because our train was shunted aside because there are other priority trains coming through. So we arrived in Mauthausen late at night, middle of January. Many men had died in the boxcars. We then proceeded to be put into camps there. And I will not go into details of Mauthausen, but by the virtue of the fact that it was liberated by the United States Army, and portions of the camp were built out of stones, it is well preserved. It can be visited today, and there are a number of places on the internet where you can get information about it. In the first week of April, 21,000 men were ordered out to the front gates, and we began a march. We went down. Mauthausen sits on top of a pretty good-sized hill. We marched down to the Danube River. There was a large railroad bridge, and German sappers were beginning to put mines in anticipation of the forthcoming, the Russian army, which was moving forward. We crossed the bridge. We marched one day. We marched the next day. The second day, mind you, this 20,000 men marching is a very long line. There are soldiers guarding us and SS men guarding us with rifles. And if somebody fell and was not able to get up, an SS officer would come, point his rifle to his head, shoot him so the skull exploded, and you could see the gray matter laying all over the place. And this also has been documented by the U.S. Army. So, you know, if you get somebody that is inclined to be a Holocaust denier, tell him that the U.S. Army has ample collected evidence on that score. On the second day, I was desperate for food, and as we walked through a village, I saw a woman, probably in her 70s, a peasant woman, tending to her garden. And I ran up to the fence, and I said to her in German, "Please give me something to eat. I'm desperate. I need something to eat." And without hesitation, this woman, who saw all the guards over there, without any hesitation, reached into her apron, grabbed two potatoes, ran to the fence, and handed to me. It was an act of great heroism, and I'll never forget that. I can see the woman's face in front of me today. I don't know her name, and I frankly think I know the village it went through, but I'm not sure. We marched. That night, we were encamped in the middle of a forest, and I found two snails. And I kid my family about having escargot in a concentration camp. And the third day, we marched into this camp, which was now called Gunskirchen, because it was outside a small village of Gunskirchen. It was in the middle of a forest, very hastily built, barbed wire fence around it, no toilet facilities. And from April the 1st till the 4th of May, we were shoved in there with very little food, and people were dying at a very fast clip, both because we were really starving, we were starving to death, and also typhoid fever became rampant. On the 4th of May, the guards disappeared, and myself and four of my buddies decided to make our escape from the camp, not knowing that a few hours later there would be an American unit arriving, and that unit was the advanced elements of the 71st Infantry Division. In that lead platoon was a man named Edward Zabrowski. Edward was 20 years old. He was a corporal, and subsequent to his retirement, he wrote a book, which I purchased, and I would like to take just a moment here or two to read from his words. The book encompasses actually his very first experiences in the Army and his entire experiences to the conclusion of the war, and this is chapter 13. It was May 4th, 1945, and our platoon had just gone through Lambach, Austria. As usual, white sheets were billowing out of the windows, and there were no German soldiers in sight. Since leaving Braunau, the village where Adolf Hitler was born, there had been no real resistance, and the Germans were surrendering in droves. They were coming out of the woods, the houses, the barns and the cellars, with their hands clasped on top of their heads, their weapons discarded. We just pointed them down the road where the frontline infantry battalions were eventually picking them up. It was a bright spring day, and we were traveling slowly on a narrow dirt road. The 2 months we'd been in combat taught us to be on guard at all times, and the day was no exception. Even though we felt the war was finally coming to an end, we knew there were still many Germans who were determined to fight to the bitter end, especially the Waffen-SS. The dust the jeeps kicked up was dense and stifling. I kept my left hand over my mouth and nose, holding my M1 with my right. That was when we entered a thick forest of pines. At first, there was the fresh, clean smell of pine that filled the air. And then another scent, initially difficult to recognize, but definitely repugnant, drifted through the air like a noxious gas. It gradually became stronger as we penetrated deeper into the woods. The sunlight was quickly obliterated, and a sudden change made it difficult to see. It was like entering a different world that had a foul and loathsome landscape. Off to the left, a few yards from the road, we saw what looked like a pile of old, dirty, discarded clothes. As we came closer, we were shocked to see the pile move. A face slowly turned toward us. It was smeared with grime, the skin taut against the bones of the face, emaciated, the mouth open and mumbling unintelligible sounds, the teeth rotten stumps, the eyes like empty black holes looking at us, but not understanding the images transmitted to its numb brain. Vermin were crawling over encrusted ulcerations. One arm rose from the muck in which he lay, extended toward us in an excruciating plea for help. Was this a human being, I thought, shuddering? Or was this some pathetic, starving, filthy, injured animal that had escaped from a monstrous and insane keeper? As our eyes adjusted to the light, we saw others gradually form in the darkness of the woods, rising from the decaying ground like corpses from the graveyard, first a few, then hundreds. For everyone we saw rising in a horrible, irregular, agonizing succession of motions, we knew instantly that there were hundreds of others who would never rise again. The stench was so overpowering it made us gag. There was a mighty, moving swell of human excrement, urine, and rotting flesh mixed with the acrid smell of German tobacco smoke. It hung about us like a poisonous gas, suffocating, sticky, pungent, clinging to our clothes, our hair, and our nostrils until we thought we would never breathe good, clean, fresh air again. I kept seeing them slowly dragging toward us, just as in my dreams that night, their movements jerky and unsteady, hesitant, awkward, their eyes blank and devoid of emotion, not yet aware they were now free men. They gestured feebly with their fingers, pointing to their mouths, Wasser, Brot, Essen, fragile words cast upon the damp forest air like dead leaves, whispered softly and barely audible so that we were not sure that we heard them at all. The chapter goes on, but I think this gives you some idea of what these young GIs, 20, 21, and 22-year-old, ran into. Now, Sergeant Zabrowski, a very bright man, and I had the privilege to get to know him when the 71st Infantry Division had its reunion here some years ago. And so we'd call each other 2-3 times a year. He came and spoke at a Yom HaShoah day. Yom HaShoah is the observance of the Holocaust. And in his speech here in San Antonio some years ago, he said that his intentions were to become a journalist. But that 24 hours that he spent in this camp made such a profound impression on him that he decided to dedicate his life to medicine, to the healing of human bodies and human souls. And he became a very distinguished physician. He retired some years ago, but his son is continuing his practice in Connecticut. That night, my four mates and I, five of us, traveled through the forest. We came upon a cottage in the middle of the forest. There were two very old women and a very old man living there. And we knocked on a door desperately. They opened it up. It was already well past midnight. They were absolutely scared to death. And we pleaded for some food. They quickly made a stew for us. We ate it, but we really proceeded. We thanked them, and we quickly ran away from there, thinking that there's some chance that SS might come back and we'd be in mortal danger. Problem was that we had not had anything to eat for weeks and months, and the food was quite rich. Our bodies were not able to absorb it, and we had the diuretic revenge for the next 5-6 hours. By 6 o'clock in the morning, we arrived at the highway, which later we found out was the principal highway connecting Salzburg, Linz, and Vienna. There were no expressways in those days. By 6 o'clock in the morning, we arrived at the highway, which later we found out was the principal highway connecting Salzburg, Linz, and Vienna. There were no expressways in those days. And we were so out of wits and so weak, and fear had abandoned us at this point. We said, let's just go ahead and start marching in an easterly direction. And we began maybe less than a half a mile, and we saw a strange-looking vehicle coming from the distance, and it stopped, and we stopped, and we started waving because we knew they weren't Germans. And lo and behold, what turns out to be an American Jeep with three infantrymen, a M50 mounted on top. It was a sort of a homemade thing the GIs did in WW2. They mounted an M50 on top of a Jeep. And we began talking to them and telling them who we were. Of course, I had striped uniform. Part of my uniform was still striped from my Auschwitz days. And as they began to understand who we were, one of the GIs jumped out. The four other men were in their late 20s, early 30s. This GI jumped out, put me in a back seat. The Jeep spun around, took us back to the outskirts of Wells, the city of Wells. And he lifted me out, and at the outskirts of the city was a mobile hospital field unit, United States Army, and I don't know the designation of it. But he called three GIs over, and they came, they brought a stretcher. They cut my clothes off of me because I was covered with lice. My body had large, pussy incrustations. I was really quite skeletal and probably not too far from dying. And one of the GIs took his sponge and began sponging my body, and the whole time he was doing it, tears were flowing down his eyes. It probably was one of the more emotional moments of my life. And I fell asleep. My other mates came. We took an abandoned house and we lived there for a day and a half. But meanwhile, the United States Army authorities were so concerned because we were had many typhoid cases, and they were afraid that many of us would die and we would infect the rest of the population. So they collected all of the prisoners that were able to get out of this camp, Gunskirchen, and they transported us to a military establishment which was very similar in Austria to what Randolph is here. It was a pilot training facility. It's about 12 kilometers from Linz. It was called Hershing Luftwaffe base, and they arranged for food to be cooked round the clock. We lost quite a few men dying in the first and second week, but those of us that were healthy began to gain weight, and we rapidly
regained our strength. I was able to write to my grandfather who lived in New York. And subsequently, I went back to Czechoslovakia to find my parents, who I then found out had been killed. I also had an uncle who had served for 4 years, the last three with the 82nd Airborne, and he was stationed in Berlin, and my grandfather wrote to him and told him where I am, and he came and fetched me, and I then moved to Germany, where my sister, who also survived, lived, and we came to the United States in 46. As Buckner was nice enough to tell you, I went through high school and the university, and right after, in the summer of 52, after my graduation, I received greetings from Uncle Sam. And all of a sudden, I had a green uniform on. Of course, I'd become a citizen the year before, and I was very proud of that. And I was sent to Camp Breckenridge, Kentucky. But in the process, I'd also took some language tests. I spoke fluently German. As I do today, I speak fluently Hungarian. My Czechoslovak is a little weaker, and I spoke a little bit of Russian in those days. And so I passed linguistic exams, and I went through basic training, which I don't know if some of you did. You know, somebody liked it, somebody didn't like it. I liked basic training. And I was so proud on my graduation day. It was a very difficult, long 2 weeks bivouac and a forced march back with full field equipment. But I thought I was Mr. Gung-ho. And I had all the intentions of being sent to Korea as an infantry replacement until I got my orders. Looked at it and I asked some of the older GIs what it meant. And they said, oh, that's United States forces in Austria. So lo and behold, I left Camp Kilmer on a ship. This is back in the ancient days when people were still taking ships to go overseas. And we ended up landing in Livorno, Italy. And a train took us. And after some card games, we were all tired and we fell asleep. And we woke up at 5:30 in the morning at the railroad station in the middle of Camp Hershing, the place where I had recuperated. But it now was Camp McCauley. It was the headquarters of the 4th Armed Reinforced Regimental Combat Team. And so after a couple of days processing, I eventually joined my unit in Linz, Austria, where I served for a year and a half. Oh, I guess I shouldn't do that. I had a really good tour of duty. It was very interesting. We were interrogating escapees from the Iron Curtain because we lacked the intelligence in those days that subsequent years, the U-2 flights and the satellites brought to us. So we were sort of the two-legged satellites in those days. Anyway, I came back, worked in Joliet for a number of years, had the good fortune of meeting my wife, Millie. Another good thing happened to me. I moved to San Antonio, and I've lived now here for pretty close to 35 years, and it's been good 35 years. And a good portion of those goodness of those 35 years were the love and affection that I've received from many of the citizens of this wonderful city. I very much appreciate the hospitality that you have extended to me today. I've been asked by Buckner Fanning to do this, and I'm very happy that I was able to share my story with you today. Thank you, and God bless you all.